We want to be determined by the data.
Fuel and electricity providers are making record profits in the EU. That's good for government tax collection, but it doesn't tell the full story. For example, on paper, the Republic of Ireland has one of the best performing economies in the Eurozone. Latest official data shows in that country a record 12,500 people, including thousands of children, are homeless. Sanctions against Russia and financial support for Ukraine are factors that continue to place enormous strain on the EU's economy. Many citizens point the finger at Washington.
What the United States decides, Europe has to follow, unfortunately. And I don't think it's the best solution to keep sending weapons.
War costs a lot. I think many, many industries are earning a lot of money thanks to the war.
We've raised these issues with the EU's executive arm, the European Commission.
We can send billions of euro to Ukraine, but is there a coordinated response in terms of the social justice problems and the cost of living crisis in the EU?
At least 15 million people, including at least 5 million children, should be lifted out of poverty by 2030. And all member states have presented their national targets to contribute to this joint ambition.
But critics of EU foreign policy suggest citizens will continue to pay a big price for many years to come. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Ashura, the 10th day of the month of Muharram on the Islamic calendar, is a day where millions of Shia Muslims worldwide commemorate the Prophet Muhammad's grandson, Imam Hussein, who was martyred by forces loyal to the tyrant of the time some 14 centuries ago. Traditionally, the legacy of tragic event has been mourned inside the Muslim world, but is now spreading to new regions, including in areas where hostility towards Islam remains high. Thousands of Shia Muslims live in Turkey to raise awareness among new Western audiences of Imam Hussein.
Prior to the arrival of Shia Muslims, very few Danes would have even have heard of Imam Hussein's great sacrifice at Karbala all those centuries. But now the community faces a new challenge, not only to educate the locals about Islam, but how to effectively combat the shocking rise of aggressive anti-Islam activism from far-right activists.
In this year's march, demonstrators held copies of the Quran as a peaceful response to the recent desecrations of the holy book by the far right, witnessed in Denmark and other Scandinavian countries. The desecration of religious sanctities is a vile practice which local authorities refuse to ban despite the great distress caused across the Islamic world.
When we talk to journalists from Danish TVs, they don't understand why we react, some of us, on a different way than just ignoring the burning. What we are afraid of is that it can start with burning the Holy Quran, it can continue with other holy scripture, but that is not what we are afraid of. We are afraid of that it would end as it did with Jews in Germany. Today we have had up to 12,000 participants, and they are growing every year. MashaAllah. This is one of the good things of promoting Imam Hussein, and especially his principles.
Ironically, despite becoming a hotbed of Islamophobic acts, Denmark boasts the largest Shia Muslim mosque in Europe. Local worshippers say despite the hatred shown by some individuals, many other Danes are learning more about Islam, with Imam Hussein's story central to their understanding of Islamic teachings and values. Robert Carter, Copenhagen.
Multipolar world and invasive security were the main headlines of the talks that Russian President Vladimir Putin held with African leaders. Other issues were also discussed in the summit, including the food security. Withdrawal from the grain deal with Ukraine will allow Russia to accelerate the research of relations with African states. The food issue is exactly what the authorities can cling on to restore the ties lost after the collapse of the USSR. Representatives of African countries see Russia as a reliable partner, and thanks to this, Moscow has a good chance to firmly gain a foothold on the continent again. Putin has repeatedly stressed that Russia is ready to work together, hand in hand with African friends, to work for the future, to build a truly strategic interaction and partnership.
In the coming months, in the next 3 to 4 months, we will be ready to provide Burkina Faso, Zimbabwe, Mali, Somalia, the Central African Republic, Eritrea, with 50,000 tons of grain and fertilizer free of charge, and we will also provide free delivery of these products to consumers.
Moscow has once again written off $23 billion as part of African debt relief, implementing energy projects in 30 African countries, and is ready to settle accounts with African countries in national currencies. The descendants of prominent African leaders announced the creation of the Pan-African Anti-Colonial Legacy Forum. Among them are the descendants of Nelson Mandela, Gamal Abdel Nasser, Ahmed Ben Bella, Julius Nyerere, Samora Machel. New branches of Russian universities will be opened in Africa together with the enrollment increase of African students in Russian universities.
Russia has delayed its return to Africa. We should have done this earlier, especially since Moscow has such a good heritage in Africa. In Soviet times, Moscow has always supported liberation movements in Africa, supported humanitarian and economically. The USSR built a lot in Africa, developed a huge number of projects. After the USSR collapse, Russia was deceived in its choice of a pro-Western vector. The result is the expansion of NATO countries by the border. Moscow is once again resuming its relations with Africa countries when the Green Deal is completed and African countries again nations help.
The Russia-Africa summit was attended by representatives of those countries and presented the majority of the African.
With Russia's strong return, an opportunity to completely get rid of Western colonial and also now tap into their natural resources and benefit from Russian experience in various fields such as security, agriculture and energy to fuel the growth of their countries. Marina Kartanova, Moscow.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol celebrated the 70th anniversary of the signing of the Korean War Armistice, honoring veterans of the war visiting Busan for the event. President Yoon again emphasized the importance of the country's alliance with the United States.
South Korea, as a responsible member of the international community, will stand in solidarity with free democratic countries. Also, with the South Korea-U.S. alliance as the linchpin, will protect peace, freedom, and prosperity of not only the Indo-Pacific region, but the whole world.
Still, many see President Yoon's strengthening of the alliance, resumption of large-scale military drills, and deployments of U.S. nuclear-capable ships and aircraft creating a barrier between North Korea and South Korea. North Korea remains under U.S.-led United Nations Security Council sanctions over its missile and nuclear programs. Sanctions which critics say only hinder the country's economic development. Near the border with North Korea, NGO leaders from around the world called for the armistice to be replaced with a peace treaty.
We are here because after 70 years, the Korean people deserve peace. We are here because people around the world need to hear more about the impacts today of this ongoing war, including the very real human impacts. We believe that sanctions and pressure will not resolve the situation, but instead we need dialogue and cooperation.
North Korea, meanwhile, this week celebrated the armistice as a victory over the U.S. and South Korea, as congratulatory delegations from China and Russia visited Pyongyang. The fortified border of the DMZ is just a few kilometers along National Road Number 1 behind me, across Unification Bridge. Despite the cycles of military tension, these symbols suggest there are many people in South Korea, likely North Korea, and around the world that remain optimistic about efforts toward peaceful relations. Frank Smith, Paju, South Korea.
In the midst of Iraq's 1980s war on Iran, the terrorist Mojahedin-e-Khalq organization, a key ally of Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein's Ba'athist regime, launched a brutal attack to overthrow the Islamic establishment in Iran. The attack that took place on July 26, 1988, was the Saddam regime's last attempt to score gains after the Iraqi forces failed to capture even an inch of the Iranian territory during almost 8 years of war. Saddam's regime and the MEK came up with a ferocious blitz aimed at infiltrating from the central western borders of Iran into Kermanshah province. It meant to capture the capital, Tehran, execute the political leadership, and announce a power grab before Iranian reinforcement troops could be dispatched from the country's southwest. The MEK had joined the Iraqi operations since the early years of the war, but this time it wanted its own members to perform the operation. The Iraqi regime had provided 7,500 members of the terror cult with modern weapons and military equipment. The new strategy aimed to win the support of the Iranian people and establish an MEK-run puppet regime in Tehran, but to no avail. Iranian people regard the MEK members as invasive aggressors, so they responded to them by live fire. It was a surprise attack, as it occurred just days after Tehran and Baghdad accepted a UN resolution that ended the war and the front line was relatively calm. However, Saddam's ill intentions were met by fierce resistance from the Iranian people and armed forces. Iran's military launched a counterattack codenamed Operation Mersad and foiled the MEK operation just within 3 days by inflicting nearly 5,000 casualties on the terrorist group's members. Operation Mersad is of the essence in the region's history, as it is the last battle during the Iraqi-imposed war on Iran. It dashed Saddam's hopes of defeating Iran and thwarted the MEK's sinister ambitions. The MEK, now based in Albania, has carried out numerous terrorist attacks against Iranian civilians and government officials since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. Out of nearly 17,000 Iranians killed in terrorist attacks over the past four decades, about 12,000 have fallen victim to the MEK's acts of terror. The European Union, Canada, the United States, and Japan had previously listed the MEK as a terrorist organization. In 2012, the group was taken off the U.S. list of terrorist organizations. The EU followed suit, removing the group from its list of terrorist organizations. Washington and its allies even give the terrorist group all-out logistical and monetary support, hosting its meetings on their territories while speaking of human rights and world peace.
The Islamic Republic of Iran's Air Force has wrapped up the 11th edition of aerial drills codenamed Defenders of Velayat Sanctuary. During the two-day nationwide maneuvers, Air Force units conducted a full range of operations and exercised various tactics using drones, fighter jets, transport, logistical, and refueling aircraft, as well as air ambulances. The operations were conducted over various areas from the Persian Gulf to the northwestern and northeastern regions. The main stage of the drills kicked off in the central province of Isfahan on Sunday night, as fighter jets and bombers carried out nocturnal operations and detonated the mock enemy's ground targets with Qasid-upgraded standoff missiles. The Iranian military drones also conducted major operations. Various combat, reconnaissance and electronic warfare UAVs such as Kaman 12, Karar, Mohajer 6 and Arash destroyed targets using different modified bombs with pinpoint accuracy. On the sideline of the drills in Isfahan, the chief of staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Bagheri, hailed the Air Force for achieving the main objectives of the maneuvers, saying the country's military preparedness prevents enemies from taking any hostile action.
The Army's Air Force has provided a very suitable and acceptable level of security for Iran's airspace from the north to the Strait of Hormuz and the three islands of the Greater Tomb, Lesser Tomb, and Abu Musa. With this level of readiness, no enemy has the capability to penetrate and violate the airspace of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Major General Bogheri also said the power, readiness and vigilance of the Air Force will constantly improve, promising a brighter future ahead. Iranian military experts and technicians have in recent years made substantial headway in manufacturing a broad range of indigenous equipment, making the armed forces self-sufficient. Homegrown Iranian military products have also found many clients in the world. Iranian officials have repeatedly warned that the country will not hesitate to strengthen its military capabilities, which are entirely meant for defense.
This massive exercise is aimed at bolstering preparedness of the Iranian Air Force. It also serves as a clear warning message to the enemies of the Islamic Republic against any act of aggression. Mahdi Abbasian, Anorak.
The United States Federal Reserve raised the interest rate once again, reaching its highest level in 22 years, with no indication for when it will return to normal.
We'd be comfortable cutting rates when we're comfortable cutting rates, and that won't be this year, I don't think. Inflation remains well above a longer-run goal of 2%. Growth in consumer spending appears to have slowed from earlier in the year. Although activity in the housing sector has picked up somewhat, it remains well below levels of a year ago, largely reflecting higher mortgage rates.
Low consumer spending spells major trouble for an economy in which consumer spending provides 70% of GDP. The housing sector just saw its first price decline in 6 years, and housing is the primary financial asset for the average family.
A well-known byproduct of prolonged high interest rates is that it will cause precarious businesses to go bankrupt and provoke mass unemployment. Data shows this is already taking place.
Corporate bankruptcies just hit their highest first-half levels since 2010. Planned layoffs are at the highest first-half levels since 2009. The damage done by prolonged high interest rates is revealed by the highest level in years for credit card, car loan, and other debt, and all while still failing to reduce record prices for the most basic goods.
People are suffering from it, and a lot of more people are going to food banks to get food because they can't afford to buy a lot of the food. And also the government has cut food subsidies for people who in need.
Despite the economic hardship, Washington has ended key coronavirus-era programs, with health insurance just revoked for millions of people. States are reporting their first increases in years for their poverty rates, all of which contributes to President Joe Biden's near-record-low approval rating.
Yeah, they might cause Biden to lose the election because he's not doing enough about inflation. I'm sure he knows that. I mean, people are going to, whatever, if it's going to be Trump versus Biden or whoever, people are going to vote for where the economic situation, where they think it's going to be better. Because most people see the two parties as being the same.
There are other ways to curb excessive prices that don't burden the working class, such as price controls, limiting corporate profits, preventing price gouging, and increasing wages. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
the supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging. And to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it. And leave no grief unless Thou takes it away. And leave no enemy. And leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O Patron of Beneficence.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
And welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. And the United States has announced a $345 million weapons package for Taiwan. The total package allotted this year will be $1 billion. And to expedite the delivery, Washington has used what is known as the Presidential Drawdown Authority to pull the weapons and equipment directly from the inventory of the Department of Defense. Now, this procedure has only been used once before, and that was for Ukraine. The question is, why does Washington want to accelerate a conflict with Beijing? Just as Russia had stated that Ukraine was its red line, Beijing has told the United States that Taiwan is its red line and an integral part of China. Does Washington want war with Beijing? Well, stay with us as we take a look at all of this on this Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Ken Hammond, professor of East Asian and Global History at New Mexico State University, out of New Mexico. And William Jones, Washington Bureau Chief, Executive Intelligence Review, out of Washington, D.C. Thank you both for being with me. Well, let's start off with Ken. I mean, where do we begin, Ken? What happened to change the U.S.'s One China policy perspective? Let's start from there, which it had been adhering to more or less for decades.
Well, the shift really in American policy starts about, almost 15 years ago, certainly 12 years ago. The United States political elites had anticipated for a couple of decades that China was going to, as it reformed its economy, as it became more integrated with the global economic system, that China was going to go through a political transition. That the Communist Party would somehow be either overthrown or simply become irrelevant, and that China would go through a kind of color revolution, the way that we have seen the United States, pursue these in other countries, and that would allow China to become a subordinate part of the global capitalist system centered on the United States. But that was never going to happen. That was never China's intention, or they were certainly aware of that danger and did everything they could to avoid that. And as China, by the beginning of the second decade of this century, became more self-confident, became a little more proactive, a little more assertive in its relationship with the rest of the world, resuming the kind of role in global affairs that it historically had played for many, many centuries, American elites turned against China. They said, well, they're not going to join us, so we have to find a way to stop them. We have to find a way to slow down their progress, to, if possible, derail their development. And we get things like President Obama announcing the pivot to Asia, Secretary of State Clinton at that time calling for a new American Pacific century. And that only deepened under the Trump administration with the trade war that was launched, and now the Biden administration pursuing its own very hostile, very aggressive policies towards China. It's basically an issue of the United States fearing the loss of its power, its prestige, its privileges in global affairs, the dominant role it has played as a global hegemon for decades. That's ending, and they don't like that, and so they're trying to find ways to demonize and derail China.
Well, William, I mean, there are a lot of economic relations between the United States and China. I mean, one of the reasons it was said that some American officials were going to Beijing was actually to talk about this, basically this coexistence that they both need to have. So what happened to all of this in the middle of what we're seeing right now and all of a sudden this package being approved?
Well, it's that initiative is not over by any means, although the initiative was not enough to try to end the crisis between the United States and China, which really came to a tipping point with the visit of Pelosi to Taiwan. Both sides are interested in having these high-level dialogues, but China has made it very clear that it's not simply that we will talk. It's if you want a real relationship, there has to be mutual respect. There has to be win-win cooperation. There has to be a willingness to listen to the other side and to take concern to its core interests, one of which, of course, is Taiwan. The United States has not changed its policy officially. It's still reiterated by Secretary Blinken in his meetings in Beijing and also by President Biden. Nevertheless, on the ground, what is happening is that there's an attempt to bring Taiwan somehow into the mix of a defense strategy, which is motivated primarily by the U.S. reaction to the success of the Belt and Road Initiative, which has really brought China to the center of world stage and created a lot of goodwill within the global South. This, more than anything else, has been the primary concern of the United States with regard to China's rise, if you will call it that, and that therefore they're taking every measure to defend against this, not by breaking, at this point, not by breaking with the policy, of the One China, but by effectively undermining it by trying to arm Taiwan as a fortress in an overall containment strategy which is aimed at China. And if they go too far with this, this will lead to conflict. At the present moment, there's a certain understanding of that, not by all the parties. And we are in a very tenuous situation, which reminds one, you know, very much of what happened just before the Ukraine crisis and the decision by Russia to move into Ukraine.
Right. Well, Ken, is it possible that there is a divide between the State Department and the Pentagon in the way that the U.S. should deal with China? Or is this just part of a game or strategy? Because, again, we saw American officials go to Beijing and talk about improving ties. And then on the other hand, we see this package, this weapons package, and so many other things going on that has been approved. So is there a divide or not, you think?
Well, I'm not sure that there's necessarily a divide between the State Department and the Pentagon, although certainly the Pentagon is very interested in anything that enhances its influence and its prestige and its ability to, you know, deploy its assets and get more resources constantly, you know, trying to draw more assets to itself. But I think what we've seen has been a pattern of not just, you know, rivalry or differences of opinion between maybe separate institutions, but even within the State Department, within the White House. We see one thing being said one day and then something completely different, indeed often totally opposite, being done the next day. Secretary of State Blinken goes to Beijing and reiterates the commitment of the United States to the One China policy and talks about getting conversations going and getting the relationship back on a better pattern. And the next day, President Biden denounces Xi Jinping as a dictator and characterizes China again in this sort of demonic mode. We see, the visit of Kerry, John Kerry, the visit of Janet Yellen. These touted as efforts to get the dialogue going again. And then we have this action of turning around and ramping up arms sales, arms deliveries to Taiwan, and furthering the rhetoric of supporting Taiwan independence.
So why do you think that we're seeing this difference? What's going on in your perspective?
Yeah, no, I think we're seeing very much a difference. And I think that it's what William said is that the United States is not actually willing to break with its relationship with China. The relationship between the countries economically is so profound that it would be devastating to the United States as well as very harmful to China. So they want to put pressure on China. They want to try and force China to maybe devote resources to military activity that otherwise they might devote to further improving the lives of their people, a strategy that they played out against the Soviet Union back in the 1980s with great effect. But that's not going to work because China is already at a much more advanced stage of economic development and much more capable not only of pursuing its own course of improvement, but also, as William was saying, sharing with other countries through initiatives like the Belt and Road. It has a much broader base of international support as well.
Well, William, China has repeatedly said that Taiwan is a part of China and the island is its red line. So let's talk about that. What do you think that means when it says it's its red line?
Well, it means that the post-war situation which was established, the international situation which was created, the structure that was created after World War II, included the fact that the areas that had been occupied by Japan prior to the war and during the war would then be returned to their rightful owners, if you want to put it that way. And in this case, Taiwan was recognized as a part of China, which it had been, you know, for centuries. When the split came and the KMT ended up on the island of Taiwan, the U.S. played a different game since the KMT was calling itself the real representatives of China. The U.S. supported that. But still, considering the fact that Taiwan was a part of China, which the KMT said it was. Later on, however, as China grew not only economically, but in terms of its political influence. There was more of an attempt to use Taiwan as a hedge against China in the rim, in the Pacific Rim region. Most recently, of course, you have the alliances that are being set up with Japan, with AUKUS, with Australia, trying to get other countries like the Philippines to some extent on board. And Taiwan is a key issue. Most recently, there was a member of the Pentagon, Assistant Secretary of the Pentagon, Ratner, at a hearing where he said that Taiwan represents one of the most important elements in the U.S. defense strategy. Taiwan, of course, is about 100 miles or so off the coast of China, probably as close as Puerto Rico to the United States. And therefore, if the U.S. could use this as a starting point for moves against China, this would be very dangerous in military terms. So that there are two things that are involved there. One is the historical legitimacy of Taiwan being a part of China, which is being insisted upon by the leadership in Beijing. And there's also the defense relationship that if they get if the U.S. has a defense position on the island of Taiwan, it would be like China having a defense position in Puerto Rico. And that would be absolutely unacceptable.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Ken, William has just talked about the various alliances that the United States is attempting, along with its allies, and also with the NATO spreading east and dealing with Japan. Tell me about how that affects the whole situation, and how do you think that China will have to deal with that?
Well, the United States obviously is trying to bolster its position in the Western Pacific. It's attempting, and not just attempting, it's carrying out a campaign of encircling China, expanding its bases, ramping up its troops, its military deployments in that whole area. This goes right along with the pivot to Asia that Obama announced back in 2011. You know, they're getting Japan to embark upon a course of rearmament, which goes against the fundamental commitments that were made by Japan after the end of World War II. They're carrying out actions like this visit of a nuclear-armed submarine to South Korea, which is a direct provocation both to the DPRK, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea in the north, and to China. And they're encouraging NATO, and of course it's NATO expansion, this relentless move to the east since the collapse of the Soviet Union. It's NATO expansion that has led directly to the war in Ukraine. And now they're trying to push a kind of a neo-NATO expansion into East Asia and Southeast Asia. So this is part of this very, you know, kind of desperate effort by the United States to shore up its position, to maintain its dominant role, to continue to treat the Pacific and the countries around the Pacific as if they're the natural extension of American power, a sort of sphere of influence. They see the Pacific kind of as an American lake, and they want to hang on to that. And so they're trying to shore up these alliances, bolster these defense, as they call it, these military commitments, carry out these kinds of really very provocative actions in the hope that will intimidate China or cause China to back off its international posture. And that's simply not going to happen. China is very committed to not only developing its own economy and enhancing the livelihoods of its people, but to providing that kind of assistance to other countries that don't want to be dominated by the United States, don't want to just be incorporated in an American-centered global system. And so things like the BRI or developing other kinds of international institutions to get out from under American domination, I think that's the path that China will really pursue. They don't want to be drawn into some sort of direct confrontation with the United States. They want to go about their business. And I think that that's how they will try to pursue this current situation.
Well, William, is the U.S. trying to use Taiwan as it used Ukraine for expanding its own agenda while sacrificing the population, putting them at risk?
Well, that's the case that exists today. And, of course, the Chinese are very much aware of this. There's now a recent exchange of students between the People's Republic and Taiwan and vice versa, which has been mediated by Ma Ying-jeou, who's former head of the KMT, to try and create the kind of people-to-people exchanges which did exist after 1992, after the agreement with Taiwan on the one country, two systems perspective. And they're trying to revive that again. And I think this will be somewhat successful because I think the people in Taiwan feel that they are victims in this and do not want a confrontation because they will be on the front lines of this. Nevertheless, the leadership of the DPP, which still has strong support, as we can see from the polls coming up in the next election, is playing the U.S. card to the hilt. The U.S. is doing whatever it can to try and support this, short of simply abandoning the One China policy. And at a certain point, that can lead to a confrontation. I agree with the former speaker that that's not what China wants to do. That's what they would like to avoid. But there are red lines here. They have said clearly, Declaration of Independence, that is a red line. And I would think that also, to the extent that the United States can build up a defensive wall in Taiwan to prevent an attack by the PRC, I think there would also be a decision made that if they felt this was the last opportunity, there would also be a move in that direction. But I think that the general attitude of the Chinese is that they have international support for the One China policy and generally for their policy with regard to this community of shared interests, which President Xi has been talking about. The global South, which is the global majority, is behind that. The question is, can they mobilize that opinion in such a way to change the chessboard that has now been set up for them, you know, by the U.S. policy?
Well, Kent, it was mentioned that much of this has to do with this change in the world order from the unipolar world to multipolar world, the U.S. losing its reign as the hegemon. So let's look at it from that perspective. Now, William just said that China definitely does not want war, and they would try to do their best to avoid that. What about Washington? If Washington feels so desperate that they're losing this, if we want to say, reign as the number one global power, do you think that we have certain parts of the society or rulers of that society that are willing to do whatever it takes, even if it means war or whatever, just to try to hold on to power, that they think that that's the only way they could do that? How do you see it?
Well, I think that that's a very real danger. I think that, you know, certainly the political rhetoric that comes out of Washington on both sides of the mainstream political perspective, it doesn't matter in Congress if you're a Republican or a Democrat, you know, everyone, there seems to be this is one of the few items of bipartisan agreement in Congress that we should be hostile towards China. And if anything, the only rivalry between the parties is which one can be more can talk tougher and be more macho in the rhetoric about China. And this is a very, very dangerous situation. The kinds of practical activities that the United States is carrying out The provocations in the South China Sea, the provocations around Taiwan, threatening these sending American warships through the strait, things like that, sending more weapons, sending military advisors to the island. These are all actions, and actions, as we often say here, speak louder than words. So the public rhetorical commitment to retaining the one China policy is one thing. But, when we look at the actual conduct of the American government, it's very, very dangerous. And I fear that there are those either in Congress or in the Pentagon or in the White House who may not really fully understand the seriousness of the danger, the dangerous activities in which they're engaging. China does, as William said, China has red lines. Trying to actually separate Taiwan from China, trying to declare Taiwan to be independent, would be one of those red lines. And that could lead to a conflict, an actual military conflict, which would first and foremost be devastating for Taiwan, would be harmful for China, but would also be extremely harmful for the American economy, because our economies, China and the United States, are so deeply interconnected. I don't think that the politicians who are spouting this kind of rhetoric are taking a serious enough effort to understand just how this world today is organized and how it works, because they're flirting with what could be a very, very disastrous outcome for all the peoples involved.
Well, William, just a minute. I have 1 minute or less, actually. Where do you see this going, your prognosis of the near future of Washington-Beijing relations?
Well, I think they probably will continue with the high-level meetings. I certainly hope so. There will be a lot of rhetoric and a lot of things being done, especially in the U.S. Congress, to provoke China. I think that the attitude of the administration basically is to try and avoid a conflict. President Biden probably is in charge, although he's aging rapidly, and question is if he's really in charge or if it's young Turks that are calling the shots. But I think there, and hope that there is enough sense in administration circles to realize where those red lines are. And in spite of the provocations, that they use whatever communications they set up with the Chinese to try and crisis manage, if nothing better, the situation so that it doesn't lead to a military conflict.
And on that note, thank you both for being with me. Ken Hammond, Professor of East Asian and Global History, New Mexico State University. And William Jones, Washington Bureau Chief, Executive Intelligence Review. Thank you both for being with me. And thank you for joining us for another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Hope to see you right here next time.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. The Limelight.
New research by scientists from the Indian Institute of Science, IISC, and Japan's Niigata University has discovered water droplets in mineral deposits that are believed to be from an ancient ocean that existed around 600 million years ago. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. WION News Agency reported scientists from the Indian Institute of Science
Bengaluru and Niigata University, Japan, have discovered droplets of water trapped in mineral deposits that were likely left behind from the pristine ocean. After analyzing the deposits, which had both calcium and magnesium carbonates, the researchers said that the discovery could provide key insights into a significant oxygenation event in Earth's past. Prakash Chandra Arya, a PhD student at the Center for Earth Sciences, IISC, and the researcher's lead author, said in his study published in Precambrian Research, "These mineral deposits are like time capsule for paleo oceans." According to the researchers' thesis, Earth was once covered with thick sheets of ice between 700 and 500 million years ago, known as the Snowball Earth Glaciation, one of the major glacial events in Earth's history. Then it was followed by the second great oxygenation event, which increased the amount of oxygen in the Earth's atmosphere and led to the evolution of complex life forms. However, scientists have not fully comprehended how these events were connected due to the lack of well-preserved fossils and the disappearance of all past oceans that existed in the Earth's history. They believe that exposure of such marine rocks in the Himalayas can offer some clues to the Earth's past climate. Prakash says, "We don't know much about past oceans. How different or similar were they compared to present-day oceans? Were they more acidic or basic? Nutrient-rich or deficient? Warm or cold? And what was their chemical and isotopic composition?" He added, "Such insights could also provide clues about the Earth's past climate, and this information can be useful for climate modeling." Recent study states that the deposit found by the team showed that the sedimentary basins were deprived of calcium for a prolonged period of time, probably due to low riverine input. This lack of calcium led to increased magnesium levels, with the resulting magnesium deposits trapping ancient ocean water as they crystallized. Sajeev Krishnan, professor at CEAS and corresponding author of the recent study, says, "During this time, there was no flow in the oceans, and hence no calcium input. When there is no flow or calcium input, as more calcium precipitates, the amount of magnesium goes up." The study states that calcium deprivation may have caused nutrient deficiency and created favorable conditions for slow-growing photosynthetic cyanobacteria. These organisms could have begun releasing more oxygen into the atmosphere, contributing to the second great oxygenation event, their research argues. This study was conducted across a vast stretch of the western Koman Himalayas, from Amritpur to the Milam Glacier and Dehradun to the Gangori Glacier region. Using extensive laboratory analysis, scientists were able to confirm that the deposits originated due to precipitation from the ancient ocean water and not from other places, such as the Earth's interior, for example, from submarine volcanic activity.
According to Mint News Agency, scientists believe that the Earth may have been covered by thick sheets of ice between 700 and 500 million years ago, known as the Snowball Earth Glaciation. This event was followed by the second Great Oxygenation event, which led to an increase in the amount of oxygen in the Earth's atmosphere, which led to the evolution of complex life forms.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.